Welcome back. In my last lecture, I talked about the developments in Ubaid period Mesopotamia, particularly in southern Mesopotamia. And what was especially significant during the Ubaid period was, in fact, the settlement of these extraordinarily rich alluvial floodplains of the Tigris and Euphrates in southern Mesopotamia, in primarily what's now southern Iraq and southwestern Iran. The period succeeding Ubaid in Mesopotamia is called the Uruk period, after the largest site of the time. And the Uruk period dates from about 4,000 to 3,000 BC. You might remember I noted during my last lecture that these dates are somewhat approximate, and some authors will place their beginnings or their endings within a century on either side of those times. Fourth millennium BC Uruk sites in southern Mesopotamia are recognizably descended from earlier Ubaid occupations. Although in areas beyond Mesopotamia, Ubaid sites, these sites where there had been a spread of Ubaid material culture and probably an adoption of Ubaid material culture by local people, in those sites beyond Mesopotamia, Ubaid artifacts are often succeeded by local innovations. And one of the interesting things we're going to see in the course of this talk is that there is after that yet another replacement by material from Uruk Mesopotamia. The Uruk period is one of vital transformation in Mesopotamia. And this is manifested in a variety of different ways. There were important economic changes during this time period. We see, for example, the extension of irrigation canal systems. These are not only vital for agricultural production, but they're also in and of themselves important communal activities. They indicate the ability to mobilize labor on a large scale, because by the Uruk period, these irrigation systems are becoming quite elaborate, particularly in southern Mesopotamia. It's during the Uruk period that we see the appearance of the plow. And again, the first appearance of plow agriculture is significant in this region because it's with plows that farmers can really efficiently break up these very fertile and very productive, but also heavy clay soils that are found through much of the floodplain of the southern Tigris and Euphrates. In earlier time periods, Ubaid farmers had probably primarily been using hoes to break up the land. And the addition of the plow to agricultural systems allows the exploitation of new kinds of soils that are, again, tremendously productive. There's a third innovation during this time period, which is perhaps from the point of view of Uruk period, had Uruk people been able to look into the future, more worrying. We see during this time increases in the use of barley and date palms in Uruk agriculture. The significance of barley and the date palm is that both of these plants are salt tolerant compared to, for example, with wheat. Wheat is significantly more salt tolerant than wheat is significantly less salt tolerant than barley. What this may imply is the beginning of salinization of these southern Mesopotamian alluvial soils. And salinization is a hazard associated with irrigation agriculture all over the world. It remains a hazard associated with irrigation agriculture even today. And so the appearance of barley and date palms may indicate that salinization was already becoming a problem for Mesopotamian farmers even during the Uruk period in the 4th millennium BC. And of course, if we look at pictures today from southern Mesopotamia, from what's now southern Iraq, southwestern Iran, these areas look, in many cases, fairly infertile. They look like desert or semi-desert regions, and to at least some extent, this is the result of many millennia of intensive agriculture, to be blunt, over-exploitation of the soils, and significant degrees of salinization. We see during this period the appearance of much larger communities, often walled, and again, the significance here may imply some degree of intercommunity violence or warfare. By 3100 BC, the city of Uruk itself, the modern site of Warka, probably housed 20,000 people, and it was one of perhaps two dozen such urban centers in southern Mesopotamia during this period. So at this time then, during the 4th millennium BC, we're seeing a dramatic increase in the number of such urban settlements over the preceding Ubaid period, and also a dramatic increase in their scale. The settlements themselves are getting larger. This urban growth itself probably hastened the development of the mechanisms of state control, given the necessity of governance of such large populations, 20,000 people. This virtually demands some form of at least municipal government. This also resulted in something that we take so much for granted that we don't even think of. It resulted in a separation of rural from urban life. People living in towns are living in a very different environment than are people living in farming villages or hamlets or individual farmsteads. This is familiar to us now. It's almost impossible for us to conceive of a landscape without that separation of rural and urban. And it really is with the development of urban centers during the Uruk period that we see this come into play. The example that I give when I'm talking about this with my students is the old story that everyone knows of the city mouse and the country mouse. The country mouse is visited by his city cousin, who speaks about the luxuries and excitement of city life. The country mouse thinks this is wonderful, goes and visits his cousin in the city, and sees both the luxury and excitement and interest of city life, but also the dangers and hazards of it, and flees back to the country. There's a rural-urban distinction that's not merely demographic, but it's cultural, it's ideological. Public buildings, and especially temples, become much larger and more elaborate during the Uruk period. The first bevel-rimmed bowls appear in the archaeological record. And this is a very interesting type of artifact associated with the Uruk period. Okay. These, if you take a look at a bevel-rimmed bowl, this is one of the kinds of artifacts that one would just have to describe as being really, really ugly. You know, it's not pretty. It's not like Halafian pottery that's beautifully made and decorated. It's not an elite ware, that's for sure. So what's the importance of bevel-rimmed bowls? This crudely made pottery was probably used for distributing standardized rations of food to laborers engaged in public works. Think about that for a moment. These bevel-rimmed bowls, these ugly, ugly artifacts, very crudely made pots, are serving as a signature for the existence of redistribution systems in Mesopotamian society during the Uruk period. Laborers were engaging in work on communal activities, and there was a centralized authority, probably associated with the temple originally, that was aggregating resources, for example, grain, in communal storage, and then paying out rations of grain to those laborers. So the precursor of modern systems of taxation is incorporated in those rather rather plain-looking bevel rim bowls. Over this period, the seals, the seal stamps, that had been a part of Mesopotamian economy since the Halafian period at least, they proliferate. Probably because of an increase in the complexity of economic exchanges during this time period. These phenomena, and there are a variety of other elements that I could talk about as well, but these phenomena, the appearance of these bevel rim bowls and the proliferation of seals, in and of themselves, imply a pretty massive population mobilization and a really quite significant redistribution system during the Uruk period. And as I said, these are some of the primary characteristics of early states. In earlier times, we saw the first appearance of temples as centers of Mesopotamian communities. In later Sumerian ideology, the land, the community, was the property of the gods, and the temples and priests were their representatives on earth. It's likely that an early form of this ideology held in Uruk times as well, if not earlier. We're not speaking now about contemporary societies. Today's societies, where at least formal distinctions between different sectors of society, the religious sector, the political sector, the economic sector, exist. In Uruk, Mesopotamia, the temples collected, stored, and redistributed agricultural products. They probably advised about planting and harvesting schedules. They arranged matters of water control. And they initiated and oversaw some construction of public works. So the temples, the religious institutions, played a significant role in management of the economy. There is no separation of church and state in Uruk, Mesopotamia. During this time period, complex recording systems begin to be developed, accounting systems, and through an early form of writing that is sometimes called proto-cuneiform, and that appears at approximately 3300 BC. And I'm going to talk in a later lecture about the development of writing systems in Mesopotamia and the archaeological debates about writing systems in Mesopotamia. These new means of recording were used for a variety of things, but particularly for resource control via different forms of public and private ownership. And this would often have been communal ownership. That is, when I'm talking about private ownership, it's not necessarily ownership by an individual, but perhaps ownership by a family group or a lineage. And we have to note here that one challenge for archaeologists is in trying to understand how the Uruk economy worked. We'll get back to that. What kinds of political systems would we find in these Uruk urban centers in southern Mesopotamia? By the end of the Uruk period, closer to 3000 BC, there are written references to rulers in southern Mesopotamian urban centers. And these urban centers can at that time at least probably be best thought of as small city-states. The exact characteristics of governance remain obscure. There certainly seems to have been significant degrees of political centralization within these small city-states at this time, as well as an elaborate and developed social hierarchy. These states were not the all-powerful theocracies that earlier archaeologists sometimes imagined, but they were politically centralized with substantial means of political control and coercion. One recurring element is that a lot of control in these urban centers seems to have been in the hands of particular communal descent groups. As I said, lineages and clans that often seem to be associated with particular estates, farming estates, or certain production specializations involved in the production of, for example, ceramics or fabrics. And this probably harkens back to the Ubaid period. So we have to think of political governance in Uruk, Mesopotamia, as existing as a sort of a tripartite governance that involves the ruler, the temple, and powerful clans and lineages. This political role and economic role for communal descent groups, kinship groups, clans and lineages, is extremely common. We are, during the Uruk period, at a stage where different kinds of venues for communal action are just developing. And kinship is one obvious way of arranging communal effort. Who do you trust? You trust those people who are related to you. And obviously, this is something that didn't disappear 6,000 years ago. This still plays an important role in economic and political activity in different parts of the world. We can thus see that the old kinship units that probably helped organize communities in earlier time periods, in farming villages, in Ubaid towns, did not go away with the appearance of early city-states. Rather, they were to some degree superseded, or at least counterbalanced, in political life while retaining their importance in other spheres. Long-distance trade is one of the most striking characteristics of the Uruk period. This is hugely important in this area because the alluvium of southern Mesopotamia, although it is extraordinarily productive agriculturally, is poor in most other resources. And this makes perfect sense when you think of it. When you think of these vast amounts of alluvial silts and clays and sands being brought down by the Tigris and Euphrates rivers and deposited in the floodplains of southern Mesopotamia, well, what's happening? They're burying other kinds of resources. If you want stone in these clay plains in southern Mesopotamia, where do you find it? Well, it's many dozens of meters under the ground surface. So these burgeoning, expanding populations in Uruk, Mesopotamia had a great demand for stone, for wood for building, for metals, and for other raw materials. The strength of this region lay in the productivity of alluvial soils under irrigation and the expertise of large numbers of craftsmen. But you still need those other raw materials. You must have those other raw materials. They're essential to support agriculture, to support craft activity, to support the ways of life of these new urban dwellers and their nobles and their kings and their priests. And we see, actually, the ways in which Uruk populations use their ingenuity at different times to come up with substitutes for materials that were in short supply on the alluvium of southern Mesopotamia. For example, I'll give you one example. One of the characteristic artifacts that actually existed since the Ubaid period in this area is a clay sickle, a sickle for cutting cereal crops, wheat and barley, but made of clay. Now, that's extraordinarily inefficient. If one needs a sickle, you can make one out of, obviously, of metal, copper, or perhaps later in later time periods, bronze. You can even make one by taking sharp stone flakes of flint or obsidian and setting them in a handle and using them to cut cereals. But they had neither of these. They had neither the stone nor the metal to do this, or at least they were in short supply in southern Mesopotamia. So people made sickles out of clay. They're not very good sickles, but that's what you've got. In the same way, the necessity of having grindstones to process these cereals that are being produced in such abundance in these wonderful soils, how can you process them without grindstones? You need to bring grindstones in. In some cases, from many hundreds of kilometers away. You need stones as well for grand monuments. You need wood for construction. You need bitumen to waterproof your buildings against the periodic floods of the Tigris and Euphrates. You need all these materials. So we see the basis for an economic system right here. During the last half of the 4th millennium BC then, Uruk trade networks were extraordinarily extensive, stretching toward northern Syria and northern Iraq, eastern Anatolia, western Iran. For the first time that we know of anywhere in the world, this involved the quite massive movement of not merely luxury goods, but staples, wood, stone of various sorts, bitumen, copper ore, and other goods over distances of many hundreds of kilometers. Since at least the Halafian period, there existed in this area a trading network in elite goods, elite ceramics, for example. Small amounts of highly valuable material, even delicate material, like pottery, being transported from one region to another. But this is different. In this case, in the Uruk trading system, what's being traded is not merely elite goods, but staples. Construction material. This is then, in a sense, a very modern trading system, and the first of such systems anywhere in the world. Not oriented towards elites or luxury goods, but towards goods needed by common people. This looks like something that we can begin to recognize as existing in the modern world. So this form of trade has resonances in our own time. It seems that southern Mesopotamia imported valuable raw materials, as I said, stone, ore, wood, and so on. And in exchange, what did they export? Well, they exported, it appears, three different classes of goods. The first is, of course, agricultural products, the products of these productive soils of southern Mesopotamia, grains, probably dates, animal hides. That's the first category. Second category, labor-intensive manufactured goods, especially textiles. I've noted already that flax used to make linen was found as far back as the Ubaid period. And it seems to have been that linen textiles were a significant export during the Uruk period as well. And third, high prestige luxury goods being exported from southern Mesopotamia in exchange for these staples coming in as imports, ceramics, jewelry, and so on. This Uruk expansion was not merely a flow of trade goods, but it also involved the establishment of Uruk settlements with artifacts characteristic of southern Mesopotamia at significant points on this trade route. Throughout this trading network, then, we see periodically archaeological sites that Uruk people were not merely trading to, but actually living on. In some cases, these are small trading enclaves, trading posts, if you like. In other cases, they seem to be more substantial towns, sometimes even with satellite villages. This implies that representatives of southern Mesopotamian urban communities, presumably traders, were establishing themselves in large numbers in proximity to areas where raw materials could be obtained and far away from their homeland. On the Susiana Plain of what's now southwestern Iran, for example, this may amount to an actual colonization of the area by Uruk settlers. In most other regions, this relationship probably involved interactions with indigenous peoples, which, as in the preceding Ubaid period, often involved an adoption of elements of Uruk material culture. That is, these Uruk trading goods were being incorporated into the lives, into the households of indigenous people in local communities beyond Mesopotamia. Such goods were especially prevalent among elite groups. I've spoken before about this patterning where we see the elite adoption of exotic and high status and high prestige artifacts. Fair enough. But what did this mean politically? Was this simply a matter of peaceful trade? Is it elite emulation of prestigious Uruk individuals or communities in other regions? Did it involve domination, political or military domination, of these areas outside Mesopotamia where Uruk material and Uruk sites occur? And who was doing the trading on the Uruk side? Did this involve competing cities? As I've said, there were a variety of different urban centers in southern Mesopotamia during the Uruk time period. These seem to have been independent political city-states. Were they competing with one another? Did this involve descent groups, kinship groups from different cities competing with one another outside Mesopotamia? Were these merchant associations? At this point, we're not sure. It seems to have been a mix of different kinds of groups in different regions within this Uruk trading network. These relations between indigenous people and Uruk immigrants and traders are today often interpreted by archaeologists in terms of what's called core periphery theory, where a developed center with power dominates and exploits weaker peripheries. Core periphery theory was developed in order to explain 19th and 20th century colonial relationships between, for example, European colonies and the metropolis in particularly Western Europe. So the situation in which we speak about colonial powers in Europe and their colonies spread all over the world, a central core of political and economic and cultural power that by the late 19th, early 20th century also included North America and Australia, for example, and then a whole variety of peripheral societies in other parts of the world. The question is, can we generalize from recent capitalist systems to entirely pre-capitalist cases of the 4th millennium BC? European powers, even by the mid-19th century, had far greater military and organizational advantage over their colonized populations, and far more ability to project power at a distance than Uruk communities in Mesopotamia could ever have dreamed of. It seems unlikely, then, that we can use these modern examples to really helpfully understand cases in Uruk Mesopotamia. To some degree, prestige and ideological dominance would have had to substitute for more tangible, physical forms of power in the Uruk case. During my next lecture, I'll talk about the continuing manifestation of these processes after 3000 BC, when we do undoubtedly have states and rulers emerging throughout Mesopotamia. Thank you.